Chapter 16. Immortal Beloved. Oil lamps smear a lustrous shine across the top hat's silken expanse. The statement in gentility is worn by a man who knows the soot-dust tang of this northern land well. Until he experienced London's permeating miasma, he believed the coal smoke of Sunderland could have been Lucifer's acrid reek. But that was years, and a lifetime ago. Now, returned, he smiles out at the crowd, assembled to listen to his message. Local industrial magnates, rough-handed intellectuals and social revolutionaries alike, fill the hard benches. Even some miners are here, rubbing at stubborn grit in the corners of their eyes, as if the hewn black gold sweats from their very bodies. Networks of tiny railways, like capillaries, bring ton upon ton of dense, inky lumps from the great northern coalfield to the Sunderland docks, from where it journeys onwards, fueling hearths, kilns, and furnaces. And vast ships, engines glowing like hellfire in their iron bellies. He knows ships, the hard biscuits and salt horse. Holds stuffed with spoils of empire and, so recently, bodies as black as his own. Removing his hat, Samuel Jules Celestine Edwards clears his throat, feels the heavy truth he carries. Its weight is the hope of generations compressed in his past, like the ancient tropical forests crushed into carbon. Speaking lifts his burden and beams light outwards from him. As before every lecture, his mind's eye blinks back to a bright island embraced by the limpid Caribbean, to his parents and their stories, his inheritance of sorrow and pride. He refocuses and begins to proclaim on natural selection and strange skulls which preach that no race should tread upon another. Of a future where man's deep shared history is his path to salvation. A year after the Feldhofer discovery and 7,200 kilometres or 4,500 miles across the Atlantic, a black boy was born. Raised in a British Caribbean colony, Samuel Jules Celestine Edwards' enslaved parents had been freed less than 3 decades earlier. Aged just 12, he became a stowaway, spending the 1870s travelling the world before landing in the northern English industrial city of Sunderland. By the 1890s, he had gained a theology degree, was studying medicine, and had become a respected and hugely popular evangelical and temperance lecturer. As if that were not enough, he was also a biographer, the first black editor in Britain of Fraternity, the journal of the Society for the Recognition of the Brotherhood of Man, and founder of a magazine, Lux. Staunchly socialist and anti-imperialist, Edwards' lecture tours drew massive audiences as he spoke eloquently on emancipation and anti-colonialism. More particularly, he noted the way that evolutionary science was racist, promoting comparisons of black people to baboons. In an 1892 article entitled The Negro Race, written in between the Neanderthal discoveries at Spee and Kropina, he made the profound observation that, rather than indicating black or aboriginal peoples were separate, subhuman races, the increasing numbers of hominin fossils implied precisely the opposite. All peoples of the earth had a common origin and were therefore united in equal capacity for intelligence, civilization, and humanity. Phantasms and fantasies. Edwards was, of course, correct, but far ahead of the times. it was the eminent prehistorians who refused to see what was in front of them. While many indigenous cultures' origin tales include enormously ancient, even eternal lineages of forebears, for Western intellectuals, the deep time represented by Neanderthals took longer to comprehend. The first inklings began with John Conyers, a 17th century apothecary with an antiquarian passion. He indulged this by picking through London's guts during massive rebuilding after the Great Fire. It was he who, in 1673, had collected the Gray's Inn hand axe found by a Mr. Lilly in gravel pits near the old spring, Black Mary's Hole. Conyers recognised it as a humanly made object, but although he understood basic stratigraphy, noting Roman pots were found beneath more recent remains, the real age of the gravels and hand axe was not within his imagination. Critical evaluations of the natural world, begun in classical times, had somewhat petrified through long centuries of Judeo-Christian tradition that only permitted a few millennia of history. But there was always a fascination with time and ancient remains, especially fossils. The paradox of living forms frozen in stone even seems to have attracted the Neanderthals. Picking up a shell from the rubble of an ancient sea and carrying it, rubbed red with ochre, across the Italian hills, far later cultures rationalised fossils by embedding them into existing worldviews. Huge bones in caves were dragons or cyclops. Stone tools, when recognised as formed by hands, were the work of elves. Only 4 years after the Gray's Inn discovery, the natural historian and chemist Robert Plot reasoned that massive bones matching no known creatures must be proof of ancient giants. They were, in fact, dinosaurs. The notion of a world filled with vanished races of humanoids alongside extinct animals was deeply embedded. Nearly 2 centuries passed between Gray's Inn and the Neanderthal Big Bang of 1856. Those years covered immense social, economic, and technological transformations, shattering Western society's view of the universe. While electromagnetism, radiation, and wireless communication may as well have been magic to the average person. During the 18th century, time itself was stretching. As the contemplation of rocks held geologists' minds over great, yawning chasms that could never fit biblical chronologies. By the 1850s, growing comprehension of the planet's vast antiquity and acceptance of primate fossils were signposts to the idea of ancient humans. Yet, for all that, nobody truly expected the Neanderthals. To Thomas Huxley, illustrious British biologist, they cracked open a Pandora's box wherein lay almost unimaginably deep origins for our lineage. He said, "Where, then, must we look for primeval man? Was the oldest Homo sapiens Pliocene, Miocene, or yet more ancient? We must extend by long epochs the most liberal estimate that has yet been made of the antiquity of man. Today, we know that all of human history separating you and the ochre brushed on the walls of Lascaux 15,000 years ago could be rerun more than twice over before you reach the last Neanderthals. It would spool past 20 times before the first of their kind." The meaning of Neanderthals was and is myriad. We have no record of the Feldhofer foreman's thoughts on realising those bones were not bare, nor an account of Captain Flint's feelings as he presented the Forbes Quarry skull. An exception to the 19th century dry scientific descriptions comes from Charles Darwin's reaction to the same fossil. He found it wonderful, and many decades later, exhilaration was experienced by new generations coming face to face with the Neanderthals. During the 1908 Le Moustier 1 excavation, Klatsch kept a vivid personal journal. Alongside professional impressions of the fossils, it describes petty team rivalries, champagne-fueled evenings filled with moonlit speculations about Ice Age hunters, and accounts of himself brooding late into the dark. The digging and the skeleton electrified him, the journal slipping into present tense and exclaiming, "What teeth!" The ancient boy really got under his skin, as he notes that the night after painstakingly reassembling fragments, "the most responsible technical task I have ever attempted," he dreamed about the skull. Neanderthals infiltrated imaginations beyond the scientific. Within 2 decades of their debut, primitive fantasy novels began appearing. They satiated public appetites to experience these captivating creatures, if only in the mind's eye. Blending with the nascent science fiction genre, it's notable how often themes of hostility and combat run through stories of Neanderthal encounters. J.H. Rosny's 1911 Quest for Fire depicts violent encounters, the original French title being La Guerre du Feu, the War of Fire. By 1955, amid the wreckage of 2 world wars, Homo sapiens evolved into the ultimate aggressors in William Golding's The Inheritors. It is us, not them, who are the insatiable predatory species, unable to perceive the sentience and compassion in Neanderthals. The general trend over following decades expanded on this, but it wasn't until the 1980s and Jean Owl's hugely successful Earth's Children series that Neanderthals were allowed to love and be loved. Owl's work is prescient in other ways. Most strikingly, her bold speculation about intimate interspecies relations was viewed as somewhat fringe. But 30 years later, genetic science showed she had been right. Hybrid babies would have seemed even more outrageous to 19th century prehistorians, though they'd also have been intrigued. Had a modern time traveller stood up after William King's 1863 species naming lecture and announced that the strange pithecoid people from the Neander Valley were, at the molecular scale present in the room, they'd have faced ridicule or riots. But even then, the Neanderthals were uniquely mind-expanding, even stimulating imaginations to travel into the future. In 1885, a clergyman with intellectual aspirations named Bouchier Ray Saville published a treatise against evolution and natural selection, entitled The Neanderthal Skull on Evolution, in an address supposed to be delivered AD 2085 with 3 illustrations. After a lengthy preface, we find the skull itself as narrator in a late 21st century soiree, on stage at Victorian London's principal concert venue, St James's Hall, Piccadilly. Opening in charming terms, "Unaccustomed as I am to public speaking," the skull assures its assumed male audience via verbose religious arguments that it can, after all, claim no human kinship. It politely wishes to part as friends, then vanishes. While much may change between now and 2085, we're unlikely to see a total volte-face in our understanding of Neanderthals as long-lost cousins. Ray Saville would not have approved of Neanderthals' place as ancestors carried within, but he was right that there is a desire for a relationship with them. This is manifest in the transfixing power of reconstructions. The earliest known visualization is an ink sketch by Huxley, doodled during a meeting. Rather ape-like, nonetheless, it has a charming vitality. The first serious attempt at a reconstruction in 1873 was surprisingly modern, with a hafted weapon and canine companion. By the early 20th century, contrasting visualizations emerged, tracking differing views of human origins. The overtly simian reconstruction of the La Chapelle Old Man was first published in a French paper and reproduced in the Illustrated London News in 1909. Bent over, absent-mindedly hefting a wooden club, and with decidedly apish pelt and feet. This representation set the primitive tone that's been so tenacious. Supposedly produced in collaboration with Boulle, its overly ape-like look may reflect his rejection of Homo sapiens as possible descendants of Neanderthals. 2 years later, the same newspaper featured a contrasting vision. Commissioned by British prehistorian Arthur Keith, who saw Neanderthals not as dead-end failures but direct ancestors, it's a far less threatening image. A man with a sizable but tidy beard sits by a blazing fire, carefully making a tool. Together with the domestic scene, a thinking, modern mind is hinted at by a necklace. Reconstructions evolved further into the 21st century with increasing levels of anatomical accuracy and gentrification. The artefacts depicted changed, reflecting richer appreciation of their culture from archaeology. But more fundamentally, their poses and especially faces are infused not with misery, but intelligence, dignity, and contentment. Sculptures are the most arresting of all, circling a body, gaining a measure of presence, looking into a face almost summons presence in a way most illustrations cannot. They too have metamorphosed from dejected creatures to people expressing confidence, joy and love, even, in one case, a cheeky sparkle. Appropriately in an age obsessed with celebrity, a 2018 reconstruction at the Musée de l'Homme, Paris, acknowledged their A-list status. Dressed by clothing designer Agnès B., this was Neanderthals literally refashioned in our image. Viewing models is, however, quite different to encountering actual bodily remains. Just as with famous archaeological entities like the Nefertiti bust or the Pompeii casts, genuine Neanderthal fossils exert an eerie magnetism that stills the heart. There's an urge to crouch down, tune out the flowing museum crowds and gaze full into those fleshless visages. In their glass case afterlives, sometimes visiting continents where their feet never trod, Neanderthals are confronted by thousands of times more people than they ever saw during life. Part of the reason our Neanderthal obsession never waned is the media. Offering a potent cocktail of science and social, even moral concerns, Neanderthals were perfect content for 19th century newspapers rolling off presses to readerships in the millions. If anything, today they're even more popular. Internet searches for Neanderthals have long outstripped the more generic human evolution, and contemporary media happily caters to public desire. Yet, science can get distorted. The flood of new data is hard enough for professionals to keep on top of. It's not helped by persistent framing around two themes, cognition or extinction. Variations on Neanderthals not so dumb after all, or they were still dumber than us, missell the nuanced and interesting reality based in process, context, and variation. But the furore over the first Neanderthal genome's revelation of direct ancestry was a fair reflection of how researchers felt. That discovery dramatically shifted public feelings probably more than anything since their discovery. No longer abstract cavemen, now they're personal. DNA research tends to be presented in black and white terms with a simple and powerful message. But much else that's just as exciting barely gets attention because the data itself is complex and difficult to communicate. This means that many stubborn clichés about Neanderthals remain, for example, that they lacked sophisticated technology and were unable to innovate. The other reason they persist, however, is that rather than discussing them for their own sake, Neanderthals are cast as a foil for ourselves. In this sense, they've always represented the ultimate other, the shadow in the mirror. To behold them is to encounter a multispectral reflection of our hopes and fears, not only for their apparent fate, but our own. Power in the past. Let's return to Samuel Edwards. Why didn't the learned scholars of the day reach the same conclusions about human evolution as the son of once enslaved Africans? Quite simply, because they were invested in a world of hierarchies that placed them at the top. Since the 18th century, scientists had not only taken the measure of the world, but also its peoples. Linnaeus was literally looking in the mirror when in 1758 he first named Homo sapiens, regarding himself as the type specimen. Right from the start, the Neanderthals were embedded in scientific justifications for white racial supremacy. Spurious notions that skull size reflected intelligence and even moral capacity had become mainstream in the 19th century, and were used to justify first slavery, then colonialism. Ethnography and prehistoric archaeology positioned hunter-gatherers as savage, in the sense of animalistic. Even Darwin, who should have known better, understanding that diversity can come from common origins, viewed the indigenous population he encountered in Tierra del Fuego, Chile, through a lens of supposed animal impulses and violent natures. And despite Alfred Russel Wallace's comprehension that hunter-gatherers and the average Victorian gentleman had identical-sized brains, he puzzled over why thoughtless beings should need such computing power. Contemporary interpretations of the Feldhofer skull make it obvious how such attitudes both influenced understanding of and were sustained by the Neanderthals. The first German newspaper reports in 1856 made direct racial comparisons, confidently describing the skulls as of the Flathead people from North America. Schaffhausen likened the anatomy to Negroes and Aboriginal Australians, as did Huxley, who casually described the former as brutal and referred to the brain of Sarah Bartman, known as the Hottentot Venus, and thoroughly dehumanised as a publicly autopsied museum specimen. William King's perspective was similar, though he preferred the Andamanese as the most degraded human race, standing next to brute benightedness. Only the previous year, skulls of Andaman islanders murdered by colonists were being shipped over to Britain for anatomical collections. The pernicious effect of such comparisons was to promote ideas that non-white populations represented primitive branches of the genus Homo. Around the same time that Samuel Edwards was writing his forward-thinking article on human evolution, Ernst Haeckel, influential biologist, correspondent, and protégé of Darwin, classified lower races closer to beasts and claimed colonialism was justified because such lives were less valuable. As the new century turned, prehistory promoted itself as nobly centred on advancing knowledge. Yet Neanderthals continued to be drawn on in bolstering racist beliefs. Claims that black people lacked the refined range of facial expressions seen in Caucasians fueled debates as to whether or not Neanderthals could smile. While discussing the La Chapelle discovery, Boole had no compunction in stating that Aboriginal Australians were the most primitive of all humans. Hierarchies of anatomical and cultural advancement in past peoples were created by archaeology, supported by illustrious scholars like Egyptologist Sir Flinders Petrie, providing ancient skull measurements. This directly fed poisonous notions of competition and racial purity that were foundational in eugenics. They're reflected in some fiction, such as H.G. Wells' 1921, The Grizzly Folk, which subtly positions the eradication of an almost parasitic, animalistic hominin race as vital to human survival. Individuals directly associated with Neanderthal fossils were part of the scientific framework. In other publications, Clatch placed Aboriginal people on a separate hominin branch stemming from Oceanian and Asian primates, and Viennet, another anthropologist who studied Lemoustier for Hauser, worked for the Race and Settlement Office, which controlled the purity of SS staff and co-edited the Zeitschrift für Rassenkunde, or Journal of Racial Science. The original Feldhofer find was within the Reich, and the Nazis forced the museum to close in 1938 because it didn't sufficiently distinguish the racial origin of the Germanic people. After the horrors of the Second World War, a growing rejection of racially based science began. Neanderthal research began to shift away from obsessions with cranial metrics towards behaviour. But the effects lingered. Prominent anthropologist Carlton Kuhn describes Caucasians as the Alpha race and Aboriginal Australians as Omega in his 1962 book, The Origin of Races. It's only during the past four decades that theories of a common human origin in Africa became really mainstream and confirmed genetically. The humanness of Neanderthals was now debated in collective opposition to Homo sapiens. This matters because heritage is fundamentally about identity, and archaeology provides material evidence legitimizing or disproving contested pasts. For Neanderthals, it's mostly been creationists, whether Christian or other faiths, who have tried to mould the fossils to their views. Bizarrely, one of the first people to gain access to the Lemoustier 1 remains after the reunification of Germany was an American creationist, Jack Kuozo. A dentist by profession, his study on the teeth formed a chapter in the publication on the skeleton. Yet Kuozo's belief in revealed scripture led to his explanation of Neanderthal anatomy within a biblical framework, and a suspicion of scientists. This culminated in a Da Vinci Code-esque book with accusations of conspiracy against him. Notwithstanding Neanderthals' reputation as the losers of the hominin games, they haven't escaped nationalist manoeuvrings. The French animosity towards Hauser's work at Lemoustier wasn't just about sales of antiquities, but also his foreign identity. Following the Franco-Prussian War a generation earlier, the public were keen to reclaim parts of Alsace and Lorraine. So a prestigious French scientific possession becoming German property rankled. Hauser himself was referred to as German despite being Swiss and was subject to rumours of espionage. He fled when First World War mobilisation began in 1914, which left the excavation records in disarray. Hauser's enduring reputation as a thief of French heritage is not entirely fair, however, since Peyronie was also making a tidy profit selling things, but to the Americans. Franco-German prickliness may persist as a comedy trope, but Lemoustier 1's national ties can still raise 21st century hackles. Specialists from nine countries collaborated to produce the definitive 2005 publication on the skeleton, a testament to international research. Yet one reviewer bristled that none of the articles were in French, despite it being Moustier 1's native country. The next year, a UNESCO-supported conference took place celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Feldhofer discovery. The museum unself-consciously referred to itself as home of the most famous German. Many hundreds of kilometres away, others are possessive of their Neanderthals. The new excavations at Shanidar came at the invitation of the Kurdish regional government. Fighting figuratively and literally for their existence as an independent nation, Shanidar signifies deep cultural history for the Kurds. Foreign scholars, not even Paleolithic specialists, report being asked during TV interviews to confirm that the Shanidar Neanderthals are in fact the first Kurdish people. While repatriation requests for human remains and cultural objects taken in the past few hundred years without consent are increasing, it's difficult to see how any particular community could claim ancestral connections and therefore ownership of Neanderthal bones. Nevertheless, the first repatriation request has already happened. In 2019, the Gibraltar authorities requested the return home of both skulls from the rock. The choice of wording is emotive and also probably inaccurate. The original living ranges of the Devil's Tower Child and the Forbes Quarry Woman would likely have been far beyond the tiny area of Gibraltar. Though their remains rested there, they may well have spent most of their lives in what's now Spain, or even the Mediterranean seabed. Human origins as a discipline is rooted in the belief that it pursues questions of global relevance on behalf of all people. But Western interests are often privileged, shown by the fact that a significant amount of past and current research comparing Neanderthals to hunter-gatherers, including studies mentioned in this book, use skeletal material from indigenous communities. At least some arrived in Western museums by dubious or outright unethical means, and there are very likely living relatives for some of the bones currently packed in plastic and pincered by calipers. It is important for the discipline to constructively engage with this legacy, so that Neanderthal research does not continue to negatively impact indigenous communities. Thinking outside the cave. While indigenous bodies, and most recently DNA, have been exploited to further Neanderthal research, their knowledge and worldviews were largely deemed irrelevant to scientific understanding of the past. But the insights of hunter-gatherer communities show how vital it is to center perspectives that don't originate in largely urban Western scientific traditions. Very different explanations for what we see in the archaeological record are possible from people with skills that many scientists lack. A recent project modelled the collaborative possibilities, inviting expert Jukwaan San trackers from Namibia to examine physical traces within European Upper Paleolithic caves. Their knowledge identified new tracks and gave fresh interpretations of what was happening in these places. No such partnerships yet exist for Neanderthal archaeology, but it's still possible to draw on indigenous perspectives in rethinking human origins. Even the question, where do we come from, isn't a universally shared starting point, since many indigenous cultures instead see original peoples as having arisen and existed outside a linear time. In some ways, that increasingly chimes with recent evidence for massive metapopulations in Africa and Eurasia, out of which we and the Neanderthals emerged. Shifting kaleidoscopes of communities separating and merging over many hundreds of millennia. Emphasizing indigenous notions of interconnectedness, unity, and relations are other ways to de-emphasize Western dominance in thinking about Neanderthals. Our biology literally limits how we perceive reality. If your eyes could perceive infrared, you'd see yourself glow. But other things can also affect the way humans see the world. Hunter-gatherers will notice things others don't, tracking being a case in point. While some cultures easily classify shades of green that Westerners struggle to even distinguish, perceiving Neanderthals' motivations that don't fit typical explanations is one way to try and apply these ideas. They may well have followed rationales matching energetics or cost-benefit equations, but their decisions would have been based in emotions, as is the norm for all humans. Beyond this, Neanderthals potentially also shared broader perspectives with indigenous hunter-gatherers, whose cosmologies are often based around relational ideas. This isn't about clumsy cut-and-paste analogies, but questioning the objectivity of assumptions most researchers already use. Using such ideas, we might reimagine Neanderthal interactions with other animals. Current interpretations are structured around themes of dominance, exploitation and conflict, life as a struggle against nature, and animals as unthinking, unfeeling commodities. In stark contrast, relational frameworks emphasize the similarities between human and non-human. Hierarchies exist, Blood is still spilled, but a relational world is filled with communities based on recognition of common personhood, of which humans are members, not masters. Human survival is not in conflict with creatures, but entwined in relationships with them. Suddenly, Neanderthal hunting and subsistence looks rather different. For hominins born into an intensely social existence, the world from the beginning is filled with entities and mutual obligations. Assuming the creatures you interact with also have minds is logical and even adaptive. Since hunting skills require attention to bodies, habits, and motivations, what Neanderthals thought and felt about animals in such a world extends outwards from their calorific value. Many of their caves and rock shelters have clear phases when Neanderthals were absent, but animals lived there. At Cova Negra, this other time, was populated by wolves and rodents gnawing at discarded remains of Neanderthals' meals. While generations of bats lived in fluttery darkness, their winter-frozen bodies falling to the floor. A relational perspective allows us to not just consider what Neanderthals made of the traces of previous hominin occupants, but of other creatures too. Conceiving of animals as thinking and feeling beings would also mean that alongside a fine appreciation for the material qualities of their bodies, Neanderthals might have valued other aspects. This offers us a context to explore how their focus on hunting particular species went beyond simple availability. Interest in birds and especially raptors is an obvious possibility, but also the systematic bear hunting at Bjarnsfast, some 200,000 years ago. Across multiple levels of river deposits, many thousands of bones show that Neanderthals hunted and thoroughly butchered at least 107 Denningers and brown bears. Though flatness is the overwhelming feature of northern France, Bjarnsfast is right at the point where the Scarp River flows north from hills to the Flanders Plains. Since bears will den in slopes with reasonably soft ground, hunting during hibernation may have been possible even without caves. But most are adult males, which doesn't really fit the pattern seen in denning caves like Rio Seco. The river itself might have provided an ambush locale, especially if adult males were distracted by fishing. But, however they were obtained, bears aren't that easy to find, and while they represent a lot of meat and fat, hunting them is more dangerous than other more abundant prey like horses or giant deer. These species were present at Bjarnsfast, but Neanderthals aren't as interested in them, preferring aurochs and bear. Heavy bear fur may well have been a motivation, and cut marks do support this. But bear hunting is least common during the colder phases here. In the absence of clear economics, a socially motivated explanation for the Bjarnsfast bears was proposed. But it was very Western. Neanderthals were intentionally selecting dangerous prey to gain prestige. However, it's equally possible that this was about something relational between hominins and bears. Intriguingly, even if many indigenous cultures consume bears, some, like the Nutashquan Innu, even naming their land as the place where we hunt bear, conceptions of these creatures as strongly linked to personhood and humans also exist, including in Naskapi, Tlingit, Iroquoian and Algonquian peoples. During the Paleolithic, bears shared Neanderthals' habits of moving into the earth to live, leaving their bones and claw marks in the same caves. With this in mind, there's another weird thing about Bjarnsfast: high numbers of butchered skulls. Bears weren't arriving here as entire carcasses, but if furs and fat were the main interest, why carry extremely heavy heads? Eyes, tongue, and brain could easily have been removed elsewhere. There's endless evidence that Neanderthals selected what they carried based on quality. In animals, that includes relative size and richness of body parts, yet here and in other places, heads are more common than expected, especially for big animals. If Neanderthal social relationships were created, renewed, and negotiated through sharing of food, perhaps animal body parts were also doing this in other ways. This raises the phenomenon of fragmentation, which was everywhere in Neanderthals' lives. Soft hammers and retouchers fulfilled functional needs, but looking through a relational window, they may have had deeper significance. First, their sheer numbers in some sites, more than 500 at Les Pradelles, is striking, and seems an overabundance compared to other places with similar activities and numbers of animals. Though most seem to be made on fresh bone, others were probably carried between places. They can even be thought of as objects representing one point on a cycle of interacting materials. Stone tools cut flesh and take apart skeletons. Then, bone tools sharpen and reform stone edges. This recursion may have had deeper resonance for Neanderthals and potentially connected to how they chose particular species and even skeletal parts. This brings us back to Biash-Samfast, where despite bears being the second most frequent species overall, hardly any of the hundreds of retouchers came from their bodies. The watching, breathless chasing, bloody unmaking, carrying and keeping of animals and their bodies was likely central to Neanderthals' understanding and emotional responses to the world. It's interesting then that though stone is much more common as a material, the vast majority of intentional markings and engravings are on bone. Again, the species marked don't match the main food sources. Think of the raven at Zaskalnaya or the hyena at Les Pradelles, which was old and potentially brought from elsewhere. Les Pradelles is a place full of material interactions and cycles. Hide working, bone napping, abundant retouches, and, from the same layer as the engraved hyena bone, the intensively processed Neanderthal bodies. Death and the responses to it are another area that's well overdue for fresh interpretations. Even without continuing obsessions over the absence of neatly dug graves, discussions of body processing tend to be limited to nutritional cannibalism or violent scenarios that say more about our assumptions than any solid data. Western worldviews regard a butchered Neanderthal as being brought down to the level of prey, captured, consumed, discarded. But imagine if Neanderthals understood themselves as living among other, intimately known entities, whose actions make sense in the same way their fellow group members do. Perhaps when bodies were touched, moved, taken apart, the borders shifted between furred, feathered, smooth-skinned. With a relational perspective, fragmenting and eating of the dead might be less about endings and more about cycles and connections within sites or across landscapes. Sometimes left as whole individuals, others joined the life-sustaining rhythm of bodies and blood and fat. When we imagine interactions revolving around more than antagonism, fear, and struggle, there's even potential to see the story of Neanderthals and humans another way. Instead of Homo sapiens as colonizers pushing into fresh lands ripe for exploitation, a different story suggests itself. A world that opens itself up, paths unfurling as seasons change, offering new opportunities. Unfamiliar lands and creatures to meet, new yet ancient peoples becoming partners in a never-ending dance. Flip the mirror, and the Neanderthals weren't powerless and waiting for extinction, but intuitive and astute, seeing incomers not as an existential threat, but as an opportunity for connection. There was not an end, but many meetings, joinings, transformations, a way to survive, to be reborn. Vanishings. However we conceptualize it, the vanishing of Neanderthals has loomed golem-like over virtually every aspect of how we've researched, portrayed, and dreamed of them. Narratives of their failure and our success have dominated. The rest of this book should have made it clear that, in fact, there is no obvious or simple answer for why we are here and not them, in corporeal form at least. There were no giant asteroids or global volcanic Ragnaroks like those that probably took out most of the dinosaurs. In these final pages, we can reconsider what happened. First, bodies. There's relatively little evidence for specific features that gave us dramatic advantages. Differences in walking were marginal, although running less so. Neanderthals' beefiness did not come at the expense of fine grip. Just as much as early Homo sapiens, Neanderthals had the hands of artisans. For virtually every anatomical negative, there are plausible counterbalances. Was it behavioural? Sometimes the Neanderthals are claimed to have been too much like piggy pandas, with restricted big game diets that couldn't cope with change. But at other times they've been accused of not being selective enough. Some of the newest isotopic research shows that Neanderthals and early Homo sapiens in Europe shared a distinct hominin niche, far more similar to each other than to furred predators. They both ate mammoth, thereby culling another theory for potential inferiority. In certain environments, a big game habit was probably the best strategy. But elsewhere and elsewhen, Neanderthals were perfectly capable of hunting small game and collecting plants when it suited them. But perhaps other challenges did them in. They appear to have disliked full-on glacials, but was the climate during the last few millennia, up to 40,000 years ago, worse than what they'd weathered before? At Geissenklösterle Cave, Germany, between 45 and 40,000 years ago, eagle owls and kestrels enjoyed many small furry meals. As rodents are often sensitive to climate, the raptor's leavings tell us that while true tundra species do become more common at the end of the Middle Paleolithic, they only really dominate after the last Neanderthals were gone. Perhaps if it wasn't intense cold, maybe the wider impact of MIS3 is what made it different. While hunter-gatherers can successfully adapt to extremes, instability can be catastrophic. After coping with the heat of the Eemian, Neanderthals rode out a series of ups and downs in climate during the later MIS5, which may even have been a time of expansions and cultural diversity. But after the subsequent MIS4 glaciation thawed, the climate got jittery. From 55,000 years ago, MIS3 degenerated into a jagged, fitful frenzy of stadial-interstadial cycles, sometimes plunging from not too bad to truly bitter within a lifetime. That doesn't mean Neanderthals lived in permanent crisis. Summers still saw sunburned faces after halcyon days on the flower-speckled steppe. But consistent uncertainty would have amped up risks, and this is visible in their core prey species. Horse and mammoth were being forced to rapidly alter their diet and were probably behaving in new ways that impacted traditional hunting tactics. Yet climate chaos can't be the full story. Recent research tracking what happened to hyenas during that crucial period came to a surprising conclusion. They were even more affected than Neanderthals by the huge decline in prey during the MIS4 glaciation, but recovered from the crash in the temporary warmish conditions afterwards, as steppe tundra and even open forest loaded with herbivores developed. Neanderthals mirror this, expanding as things warmed up again, even recolonising Britain and revealing a burst of technological diversity. The Golden Age didn't last, though. Both Neanderthals and hyenas came under pressure from declines in prey as MIS3 got colder. The carnivores hung on with their tenacious jaws, along with cave bears, in southwestern Europe until about 31,000 years ago. But in contrast, Neanderthals, who had previously outcompeted them, never made it past 40,000 years ago. Something else was going on. Based on the demographics, at least some Neanderthal groups included elders whose wisdom and experience probably acted as sources of disaster mitigation. But if the situation deteriorated beyond common memory, fleeing might have been the only option for survival. If the southern lands were already filled with other Neanderthals, then those from the north, used to relying more on big game, might have had no refuge. And there was an added factor no previous generations had encountered in large numbers: Homo sapiens. Hominin populations overall likely grew during early MIS-3. The genetics tells us that Neanderthals were definitely encountering Homo sapiens around this time, with interbreeding happening in multiple phases. Even if relations were largely friendly, competition for resources would still have been at its most intense in our collective history, just as the climate instability really kicked off around 45,000 years ago. Finishing this book in the late spring of 2020, it's impossible not to wonder if a terrible contagion might have been added into the mix, jumping from us to them. Obviously invisible on skeletons or in genomes, nonetheless, what seemed like a fringe concern over the past decades no longer appears so unlikely. Though some Neanderthal lineages were less genetically isolated than others, overall the wider population had been slowly withering for hundreds of thousands of years. For all their cleverness, flexibility, and resilience, the archaeology does suggest they had weaker and smaller social networks made up of small groups that rarely came together in large gatherings. Long-distance lithic movements get more extreme and more common as the Upper Paleolithic develops. And crucially, things other than stone begin to be carried far. Shared symbolic networks, reflecting connections with far-flung communities, are what define the post-Neanderthal world. Being welcome at the fires of friends many valleys away might make the difference between infants getting by on milky dregs or tiny hollow bodies being laid down in cold crevices. Small tragedies over thousands of years could ramp up as localized genetic pools became cut off and sluggish, in contrast to long histories of genetically small worlds and within-group reproduction visible, though not universal in Neanderthals. So far, no early Homo sapiens genomes point to similar processes. But there's a paradox. If Neanderthals tended to be cut off socially, it's remarkable there was so much contact and interbreeding, not just with us, but also with Denisovans. Climate meltdown, plus a much more crowded continent, could have provided the stage for our persistence and the passing of the Neanderthals. Think back to those European macaques who went extinct around the same time. They'd probably also been treading a fine line in energetic terms, trying to cram food, travel, and social relations into short northern days is hard, maybe impossible, in harsh winters. With bodies costlier to run than ours, teetering on the edge in extreme conditions would be very dangerous for Neanderthals. A perfect storm of different stresses may have together been overwhelming. Crucially, populations and species can vanish through factors that have nothing to do with cleverness, but that simply come down to time and babies. The fate of the last Neanderthals who did not join with us may have been more of a whispered goodbye than a war cry. A quiet vanishing accompanied by the crooning of mothers in the night. We may never discover the precise details of what happened. How could we, when every Neanderthal story from the Atlantic to the Altai would be unique? But we do already know something. The belief that Neanderthals were a failed early release hominin, on a road to nowhere, has tainted perceptions of the archaeological record for well over a century. The initial mtDNA results showing no interbreeding was always only a partial account, but we gladly accepted this as evidence. Try a thought experiment. What if we had only found the first Neanderthal fossil in 2010 with the genetic tools to immediately see where we fitted together? They would have been known from the start as a branch of the family we were only temporarily separated from, and at the same time, our 1,000 times great-grandparents. What would they have been called? And what if Denisova had been the first fossil site and we had known from the outset that first-generation Neanderthal hybrids were possible? Things look different now that we know the blood-feeding neurons, crackling like fireworks in 6 billion living brains, yours, as you listen to these words, carry the legacy of the Neanderthals. That the vast majority of living people are their descendants is, by any measure, some sort of evolutionary success. Speaking in terms of extinction no longer feels right, but at the same time, we didn't assimilate them on equal terms. Our bodies aren't identical to early Homo sapiens people, but nobody alive really looks like the Neanderthals. The fact that hybrids existed, lived, loved, and raised their own children is the most persuasive argument for our closeness at every level. Not only did we find each other attractive, but some level of cultural communication must have been involved. Everything is clearer in hindsight, of course. But if the past decade has taught us anything, it's that nobody expects the next Neanderthal revelation. Until incredibly recently, the world was sparkling with hominins. Neanderthals, Denisovans, the diminutive Indonesian Homo floresiensis or hobbits, and other tentatively named Asian populations, like Homo luzonensis, while in Africa, Homo naledi must be the vanguard for other as yet identified populations. Even for Neanderthals, researchers are only just comprehending that there's a mass of unknown unknowns out there too. The great challenge going forward will be in combining the ever-growing but very different kinds of evidence, how genetics connects to physical diversity, and making sense of them both in relation to the cultures they produced. Fundamentally, the long obsession over the Neanderthals' fate reflects our deep dread of annihilation. Extinction is frightening, even the syllables slam up against each other. Is it a coincidence that as our species belatedly wakes up to what may be its greatest threat, apocalyptic fiction becomes all the rage? In the face of obliteration, we desire comforting parables where we are always the ones who lived. What's more, we want to feel special. Most of the stories we've told about Neanderthals have been narcissistic reassurances that we won, because we're outstanding, destined to survive. Yet the Neanderthals were never some sort of highway service station en route to real people. They were state-of-the-art humans, just of a different sort. Their fate was a tapestry woven from the lives of individual hybrid babies, entire assimilated groups, and, in remoter corners of Eurasia, lonely, dwindling lineages, endlings, who left nothing behind but DNA, sifting slowly down into the dirt of a cave floor. Futures. The 21st century advances in genetics that allow us to recover Neanderthal DNA from dust can seem like magic, but they face us with dilemmas that edge into the realms of science fiction. Enormous curiosity about what made the Neanderthals different and how interbreeding affected us is driving research using multiple approaches. Extrapolating from genomes and databases of medical histories is one, but the only way to know for sure is to observe DNA in living organisms. With this in mind, biological experimentation, splicing Neanderthal genes into mice, has already begun, while Neanderthalized frogs have been studied to determine if they experience pain differently. But we must ask whether causing suffering in sentient creatures for the purpose of human origins research is appropriate. If that isn't problematic enough, there are now multiple projects building Neanderoids, small clumps of gene-edited human brain cells. Taking 9 months to grow, they're not true brains, lacking consciousness or known processing capacity. Yet they spontaneously develop varied structure, are capable of internal electrical connections, and in 2019, contrary to initial claims they would be isolated from stimuli, reports emerged that they had been connected to robots controllable through signalling. And one team plans to create a feedback system of input signals to track neural development. All these projects raise profound concerns. No open discussion within the scientific community on ethical issues has taken place. And as the research itself is not yet published, it's happening in the dark. In the absence of any professionally agreed code of practice, we're collectively inching forwards on an undirected trajectory towards self-aware Neanderbrains. Doubts over all this aren't simply about morals, but about effective science. Environment and social context have enormous impacts on DNA function, and since we can replicate neither the Pleistocene world nor Neanderthal society in a test tube, exactly what gene editing studies can achieve is arguable. Without action, even more shocking futures may come to pass. It's entirely possible that an unregulated lab will decide to put Neanderthal genes in primates, just to see. Once that red line is crossed, the risk of someone trying to create a human-Neanderthal hybrid baby is real. Some genetics experts have already half-joked about cloning using surrogate human mothers, and the 2019 unsanctioned genetically edited human babies show it's no longer out of the question. Such experiments would risk serious health issues, and it's entirely uncertain if nearly humans would receive legal protections or rights. If our ancient ancestors become objects with no consent in their own study, we are accepting humans, albeit of another sort, as scientific playthings. And for what purpose? The Earth hosts many creatures that possess sentience, intelligence, self-awareness, even culture. Not only do we fail to show much interest in really communicating with elephants, crows, cetaceans, or primates, other than chimpanzees, though only on our terms, but the scale of abuse we commit against them is a damning indictment of what we could permit to happen to Neanderthals despite knowing what and who they are. Beginnings, endings, and uncertainty are at the heart of all this. The great 19th century upheavals in comprehensions of the universe included not only a gigantic inflation of time, but also of space. Slow realizations over centuries that the Earth was just one sphere in a solar system suddenly accelerated to understanding that our Sun was itself not unique, but one among untold numbers. What was then the world's largest telescope focused on fuzzy spiral nebulae at the edges of vision and found yet more galaxies downy with stars. The cosmos in all four dimensions had grown almost beyond the limits of the mind. Within 4 decades of the Feldhofer discovery, ideas about life on the moon, encircling other stars, or in the far future were flourishing. By 1878, there were flying saucer stories. In 1893, H.G. Wells was imagining what humans would look like in a million years' time. 4 years later, War of the Worlds was published, and in 1909, the same year as Peroni was digging out the leg bones of the La Ferrassie-1 Neanderthal, the first radio projects listening for alien signals began. Tuning into the voices of the Neanderthals somehow would be a dream come true. But in some ways, they already represent our first encounter with E.T. intelligences not from off the Earth, but out of our time. The original Pleistocene meetings between them and us must have been something to behold. But 40 millennia later, the gulf between the Victorians and the entities whose bones they excavated evoked similar awe as any notion of aliens. Moreover, the profound questions this forced in the 19th century about where humanity came from and where it might be going are exactly those still asked today. Whether by prehistorians, SETI, or search for extraterrestrial intelligence researchers, or science fiction authors. What is sentience, intelligence, creativity, self-consciousness? Such themes also intersect the newest other entity that arose during the 20th century, artificial intelligence. The ways we permit Neanderthals to be human, assessing their competence as hunters, nappers, and artists, or imposing restrictions on which practices around death hold meaning, resonate with the tests for self-awareness in AI systems. True machine consciousness may soon be within reach, and we now believe that a fifth of all stars have a potentially habitable Earth-mass planet. Although the journey to such a place would be on the multi-millennial scale, one day we might reach them. If so, we will not travel alone. Along with a voice in the machine, there will be the Neanderthals inside us. The magnificence and desolation of deep time in Earth's history terrified and mesmerized early geologists. To this unspeakably old planet, populated by endless terrible lizards, monstrous jawed fish, and ammonite swarms, Neanderthals brought a kind of solace. Humanity's origins were part of this greatest story. And the revelation of their existence came not at the hand of divinity, but amid the noise and muck of the Industrial Revolution. Our first discovered Neanderthals were pulled out of the ground by quarrying, mining, infrastructure, and urban sprawl, even war. The black powder explosives that tore apart the Feldhofer Neanderthals were developed for munitions, while both Gibraltar skulls were uncovered by men only on the rock for military reasons. In today's digital biotech age, thousands of bone fragments can be painstakingly tested for hominin biomarkers. The child of a Neanderthal and Denisovan is recovered not from the ground, but tiny collagen filaments and numbers on a screen. It seems fitting that, as the first hominin species we rediscovered, Neanderthals are the one we know most intimately and are now closer to than ever. After more than 160 years, we have finally begun viewing them on their own terms. Successful, flexible, even creative, all can justifiably be applied. More than anything, Neanderthals were survivors and explorers, pioneering new ways to be human, expanding themselves through space and even in time. They experimented with new ways to fragment, accumulate, and even metamorphose material substances. Long-burning aesthetic embers and bright eruptions of symbolic engagements are there in collecting special objects, marking things and places, exploring what it meant to be dead. Let's finish our shared journey through these pages by letting your guard down. Push against the impossible and perform a quantum shift back in time to the Pleistocene. Close your eyes and pick a world, a grassy plain under cool winter sun, a warm forest track, soft loam underfoot, or a now sunken rocky coast, gulls' cries salting the air. Now, listen. Step forward. She's here. When you are close enough, press the skin of your palm against hers. Feel her heat. The same blood runs under the surface of your skin. Take a breath for courage. raise your chin and look into her eyes. Be careful, because your knees will weaken. Tears will come to your eyes and you will be filled with an overwhelming urge to sob. This is because you are human. Neanderthal, human, kindred.